is Susan Franson, and you are listening to Heart of Iowa, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and individuals of note in Central Iowa. Welcome. Today, April 22nd, is Earth Day. And to celebrate it, we'll be talking with Ed Fallon on the road with the Great March for Climate Action. If you've been listening to his weekly program on KHOI, the Fallon Forum, from 4 to 5 on Wednesdays, you've been following the story. But whether you've heard about it or not, I thought you'd enjoy his Earth Day perspective. I invite you to listen in on the phone conversation we had yesterday. Here we are talking with Ed Fallon on the road with
Great March for Climate Action.
Okay, Great March for Climate Action. How long have you been on the road?
Well, we set out on March 1st from Los Angeles in unprecedented weather that is part of it's part of the modeling that scientists have been telling us to expect. I mean, Southern California had been an extreme drought, had been rain in months, 18 months I think. And they had 4 days of rain, and the fourth day was the hardest, and that was the day we marched nearly 20 miles in torrential downpours, wading across streets in water up to our calves. It was a miserable day, but also a pretty powerful way to, you know, make a connection to the issue we're hoping to generate some action on. You know, since then it's been hard work. I mean, we continue to walk. I mean, I had a 17-mile day today, just got done. Had a 17-mile day yesterday as well, and you know, that gets tiring. Right now, the terrain has been pretty friendly. The roads have been pretty friendly, but we had a 6-mile climb up to 7,500 feet the other day. That was pretty hard, especially for those of us from Iowa. But the reception has been good. We've been getting good responses from people. They appreciate what we're doing. They're impressed with our commitment. It gets their attention. When they hear walking across America, they think, wow, why? What's so important? And then you start talking about the climate issue. And they respect that for the most part. We do have a few people who are brush us off, but for the most part, people have been pretty receptive.
Well, I know before you started, you said you'd be doing some kind of demonstration things along the way.
Yes.
Okay, could you describe some of those?
Yeah, and it's been hard to, given our lifestyle of moving every day, it's been hard to use our solar cookers to the extent that we want, but we still do use them, and we showcase them. We have two different types. We have a sun oven, it's called. It's basically an oven, and we have a parabolic solar cooker, which looks a little bit like a satellite dish, but it can be used to boil water, cook oatmeal, rice, beans. We've made, in the ovens, we've made pineapple upside-down cakes. We've made some kind of banana bread. So we've used them a lot, and they're an example of what you can do with solar energy. We also have a solar collector that we use to charge our phones and computers, and hopefully soon a mobile refrigerating unit we purchased. We also are showcasing a more environmentally friendly approach to commodes, to porta-potties. People don't know, I didn't know this, but the standard porta-potty is a pretty toxic piece of equipment, but you can turn, you can design them so that they're actually very, very environmentally friendly. And my job, my camp job, Susan, is to empty the commodes. It was not high on the list of most people's chosen jobs, and I didn't mind doing it, so here, I'm doing it. But it involves, you know, finding a place to empty the contents, but the contents aren't toxic. They're actually very good compost. And so those are a few of the things we showcase. We also have people with expertise in lots of different areas relevant to the climate conversation, and we try to give those people as many opportunities as possible along the way to speak at schools, in churches, just the community groups. So we have people coming to visit our March camp. So it's all part of the important element of reaching out and talking about why this issue is so important and what we can do about it. It's not just helpful to address the problem, but also good for our economy. I mean, the type of jobs and the number of jobs available through green technologies, it is astounding. I mean, Iowa is just tapping the iceberg, just the tip of the iceberg, with our 7,000 jobs relevant to wind energy. There's so much more happening, potentially, if we start really retooling the direction we want to go with energy production.
Well, that's very impressive. You must be in Arizona now, is that right?
We're a week away from being in New Mexico. So we are. We started out in the. Well, it's kind of interesting. Los Angeles is its own world, and when you're done with Los Angeles, you're in the desert. And Arizona, you've got more desert. Although the desert in Arizona was a lot friendlier than the desert in California. That was hard. And then you move through Phoenix, and you go up into the mountains, and we have these beautiful pine forests. And then when you get up 7,500 feet up, suddenly you're back to more open areas with juniper trees and a lot of grazing ground. And that's where we're at right now. We're in this flatter, more rolling country with lots of grazing area, lots of juniper trees. Beautiful. I mean, it's all been fascinating. It's fascinating to me, too, how quickly an ecosystem changes from one to the other. You know, we really have a very fragile planet. It's big, it's powerful, but it's also fragile. And it's and you can see how it gets affected by human activity, even on a small scale. When you start thinking about the big impacts of climate change, you know, the issues are huge. And down here, I mean, in Arizona, as in California, as in New Mexico, I think, drought is a big part of the conversation when it comes to climate change.
Well, now, when you say part of the conversation, are people talking to you about the drought?
Well, even among themselves, but we certainly talk with people along the way, and they share their thoughts on it. You know, like never seen anything like this before in terms of how dry it is. And in terms of that rainstorm on March 1st, never seen anything like that before either. But it's all, you know, we have to get used to the fact that the scientists have studied this pretty thoroughly. And if anything, their models are conservative. The things are happening faster than scientists predicted. Weather is even more extreme than they predict. But that's the model. The model is that we're going to have a lot more extreme conditions. And we're going to have, you know, sea levels are going to be rising. And we've got to be smart and begin to prepare for those changes now and begin to lessen the impact on the atmosphere where we aren't pumping so many, you know, toxic elements into the atmosphere.
What's the best thing that has happened during your trip, would you say?
Well, personally, I trained hard for this, but I've had a history of serious back trouble, and I trained hard thinking I would give it a shot, see if I could do it all. I mean, I think the statement about marching the whole way, it makes a statement about how important this issue is. And I'm delighted to say I've been able to march the whole way so far. I haven't missed a step yet. I'm actually a little surprised, but pleased. And it's required a lot of grueling days and, you know, a lot of sacrifice and determination. So I've been pleased with that. I've been pleased with the impact, too. We've been getting a good response from people. I thought we'd have more disparaging comments, more denier comments. I think we may be turning a corner on this issue, and I'd like to say I wish we'd turned the corner 30, 40 years ago, but it's not too late. We have the technology and the ingenuity, and I think we have those are available. What we're missing is the political and collective will, and what I see us doing with this march is helping in a big way to move that political will forward. And a big moment for us is going to be when we leave Denver on June 18th and start heading out across the plains toward the proposed path of the Keystone Pipeline. The Keystone Pipeline is more than just a symbol of this climate movement. If that goes through and if the extraction of tar sands oil proceeds as planned, we're going to see a tremendous increase in the percentage of carbon in the atmosphere. That will cause even more extreme conditions, more climate change, make it even more difficult to rebound and to find a way out of this problem. So the stretch from Denver to central Nebraska is a critical one. And we do see more and more marchers are signing up to join us in Denver. And we want to encourage people to do that. Certainly after we cross the pipeline, we head into Iowa. And we're getting already a pretty good reception from Iowa, which is exciting. But I think that stretch from Denver to central Nebraska is critical because of how important the Keystone Pipeline is in the climate equation.
Do you have any plans for any kind of confrontation, nonviolent action?
No, we don't. We're focused right now on marching, on education, on showcasing technologies that are sustainable, that can make a difference. And, you know, I wouldn't say that that might not happen eventually, or it might be, what I want to say is that might grow out of this movement. But right now, this movement is very focused on marching and on education and on the technologies we need to embrace.
I had a question because you said that you've already finished your 17-mile day. How early do you have to start?
Well, we get up between 5 and 5:30, and I'm usually one of the first ones out of camp because I got a lot of other things I got to do on the tail end of the day. You know, there's a few of us who tend to head out. I looked at my clock today. We started out at 6:26. Took a little break for breakfast, a town about 5 miles down the road. And then we had a longer break at a cafe where we had access to the internet and did some work as well. But normally I get in before noon. Today it was closer to 2 o'clock.
Oh, so you get there before the real heat of the day.
I try to, yeah. The heat bothers me more than most other circumstances. The length of the day is an issue. I mean, we had one guy who he had some catching up to do. He did 30 miles in one day a couple days ago. But 17 miles seems like a long day to me. Again, the average is probably around 13, 14. Tomorrow's going to be a 10-mile day, which I can probably do in my sleep at this point. It's amazing how a 10-mile walk back in your normal life would seem like a long haul. And when you're on this, it seems like, oh, that's nothing.
Now, have there been any disappointments or setbacks?
Well, it's challenging to work with such a passionate and talented group of people. There's been some challenges with that. You know, I mean, I think we're all disappointed that that we aren't bigger than we'd like to see a larger contingency. Yeah, but still, 40 people is a pretty impressive of committed activists. We'd like to see it grow. At this point, you know, even though we'd like to start it out with a larger group, the advantage is that it's been easier to accommodate a smaller group. I mean, just finding campsites for 40 and managing logistics for 40, food, water, waste disposal, tent sites. I mean, managing all that just for 40 has been challenging. So in a way, it's probably been a blessing that we've been smaller than we wanted to be. But we hope it grows because we think a larger march will have a more powerful statement.
Oh, I have a question about a sag wagon. You must have one to carry your tents and your
sag. Yes, we call that our gear truck. It hauls all of our equipment. It also pulls the solar collector that we use. We also have a pickup truck that hauls the eco commodes. That's our porta potties, and that truck stops a couple times during the march day. It'll be at like 4 miles, at 8 miles, maybe 5 and 10 miles. It stops a couple times to give people a chance to fill up with water, use the commodes if they need to, maybe sit in the shade for a little bit. We have a few vehicles. There's a few people who have personal vehicles as well, and I think one conversation we're having right now is how do we reduce can we find a way to trim back the number of personal vehicles that are on the march? So that's something we're debating right now.
Well, I have a question about your show. How
yes.
can you do 5 days a week radio show from your smartphone?
Well, it's 4 days. I haven't been doing Fridays because when I switch to 6 p.m., everybody wants to do something else on Friday evening other than listen to a talk show. So it's 4 days a week, and so far I've only missed part of one day. The show started out okay, and then we lost the signal. Every other day, even in the Mojave Desert, I've been able to do the show. It says amazing things about our technology, but sometimes I've had to be very innovative. I've been out, like I've been caught out on the trail, and I've had to find a place to duck out of the wind. I remember one day I crawled under some rocks to do my show. Several times I found myself popping into cafes or restaurants, doing the show there. One time I was in a cafe in Payson, and I just invited one of the one person I ran into there. He seemed like an interesting guy. I invited him to be on my show, and that was a great conversation. So it's worked out. It's been challenging, but so far I've only missed part of one show.
Well, now, this is our Earth Day show here at KHOI.
Right.
And so I'd like to ask if you're planning to do anything special for Earth Day.
Well, we're planning a whole bunch of things for Earth Week. And the young people on the march have been leading the charge on that. If we could direct people to the Great March for Climate Action website, climatemarch.org, and also the Great March for Climate Action Facebook page. We have a video. This is good timing, Susan. The video just came out this afternoon. It shows all the different things that marchers are committed to doing to try to push the climate issue forward during Earth Week, including a day of silence, a day of fasting, a day of letter writing. Again, my hat's off to the young people who put this video together. It's really well done. And we'd love to encourage people to look at it, to join us in some of those actions, and to pass it along to other people as well.
Now, is that both on the Facebook page and on your website?
I believe so. Again, it was just posted. I know it's on the website, climatemarch.org. I believe it's on the Facebook page as well, which is simply Great March for Climate Action.
Well, for our listeners who might not be able to write that down or remember it, it'll be on our webpage at KHOI. And as soon as this show is up on our website, it'll be on the homepage. So if you click KHOIFM.org, you'll see the Great March for Climate Action and our Earth Day show. So thank you so much, Ed.
You're welcome.
Anything you want to add?
Well, just consider joining us. It's not only is this a very powerful way to help mobilize for change on the critical issue of our time, but it's a great adventure. I tell you, it's fascinating to see the country one step at a time. I can't imagine driving through the country and seeing anything near what I've been able to experience one step at a time.
One step at a time. Well, thank you so much, and bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
You can say that you stand apart, put a fence around your yard. You can build a tall rampart, guard it with a gun. You can dig yourself a moat, burn the bridge and burn the boat. It won't matter that much, you know, 'cause all the world is one. All the world is one. You can march in a big parade every Independence Day. You can raise up your own flag, sing your own anthem. It'll ring out in the air with the other anthems there. Till the winds of the earth declare, all the world is one, all the world is one. Go and ask the Buddha when he's sitting under the tree. Go ask Walt Whitman when he's looking out at the sea. Ask Alan Shepard when he's standing up on the moon, staring at that pearl of blue. Ask an atom in the breath you take, ask the water by the river bank. Ask a strand of DNA, it's written in your blood. One life running in your veins, one life from one big bang. You can try and separate it, all the world is one. All the world is one. Go and ask the Buddha when he's sitting under the tree. Ask Annie Dillard when she's up on Tinker Creek. Ask Alan Shepard when he's standing up on the moon, staring at that pearl of blue. An outbound train, try to make a getaway. You can ride off like John Wayne to the setting sun. But earthlings don't leave town, they just go round and round till they figure out all the world is one. All the world is one. All world.
We've been listening to Ed Fallon from the Great March for Climate Action, telling us about the march and what they have planned for Earth Day. For the balance of the program, I'll play selections from a panel on agriculture and climate change held on March 30th at Bethesda Lutheran Church in Ames, subtitled Faith for the Future. It was sponsored by both faith-based groups and those based on science and public policy. And it's interesting to me because in the panel, they speak more than once about the climate conversation and how important it is to have the climate conversation. As you heard from Ed Fallon, that's what they're doing on the Great March for Climate Change. It's the climate conversation that's being furthered by those marchers one step at a time.
I'm Susan Guy. I'm the director of Iowa Interfaith Power and Light, and we are one of the co-hosting organizations of today's panel discussion on agriculture and climate change. I do want to express our appreciation to all of our co-sponsors for today. In addition to Iowa IPL, we have the Center for Rural Affairs, the Center for Energy and Environmental Education at University of Northern Iowa, Citizens Climate Lobby, and of course, our hosts here at Bethesda Lutheran Church. So just a word of thanks to all of those organizations for hosting us. Climate change, of course, is one of the most compelling moral issues of our time. And it disproportionately affects those who are already most vulnerable, both in our communities and in our world. One of the roles that we play at Iowa IPL is to help people connect the dots between the issue of climate change and so many other issues that we already care about. And certainly here in Iowa, the issue of agriculture is something that is we feel is critically important, both because it's so tied into our economy here in Iowa, but also because we really can't talk about issues such as hunger without talking about issues related to agriculture. And climate change is one of those exacerbating issues that really intensifies other issues that we may already be having. So we wanted to put together this panel today of some really wonderful experts who can really talk to us about how climate change is impacting agriculture, both here in Iowa and also globally. So with that, what I really want to do is introduce our moderator for today, Mike Glover, and Mike will introduce you to our panelists. But Mike Glover worked as a journalist at newspapers in Iowa and Illinois for 8 years before going to work as a political and legislative reporter at the Associated Press in Iowa. In that capacity, he covered the campaigning for Iowa's leadoff precinct caucuses and for 3 election cycles flew out of Iowa to cover the presidential campaign nationally. For more than 25 years, he served as a panelist on Iowa Public Television's Iowa Press program. And since retiring, Mike writes for a website, iowahorserace.com, and teaches an advanced reporting class at Drake University, where he sits on the National Advisory Board for the School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And so Mike will introduce our panelists for today.
Well, welcome all on a beautiful, beautiful day. Let's get right to it. I'd like to introduce you to the panel. To my left is Matt Russell. Matt is the State Food Policy Project Coordinator at Drake University Agricultural Law Center. He also farms 110 acres in rural Lacona. Next to him is Chris Anderson. Chris is a climate risk analyst. He's assistant director of the Iowa State University Climate Science Initiative, a research program that provides authoritative scientific information for short and long-term climate-informed decisions. Reverend Joan Fimenti, graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree in General Science from the University of Iowa, where she worked in neurophysiology. I hope I said that right. And for a decade, before attending the University of Dubuque Theological Seminary and becoming ordained. And on the end is Arlen Shipper. And he probably knows more about this topic than all of us put together because he's been farming in central Iowa all his life. He started 38 years ago. So those are our panelists. And we have, to be fair, we have prepared a series of questions to ask all of them. and so they could be prepared. We shared the questions with them in advance. We'll start off with the first one, and Matt, we'll start with you. Iowa's economy is dependent on agriculture. How do you see climate change impacting agriculture, and can our current agricultural system continue to exist if climate change continues at its current pace?
I first come to this topic under this bias or assumption, and that is that we're not going to crash the planet. The planet's going to continue to exist whether we do or not. And I watched a PBS show about Chernobyl, and people can't live near Chernobyl, but the wildlife has come back. So I would really, and the way you set this up I think is important. This is not about saving the planet. This is about saving people, saving humanity. And agriculture is fundamental and foundational. And we do agriculture here in Iowa as well as any place in the world and better than most. And we're already experiencing the effects of climate change. What we're seeing is what the scientists told us we would see. It's happening a little faster than they suggested, and maybe that's just part of the cycle. But it looks like it's probably very much accelerated by climate change. But we know what climate change is going to look like, and it looks like 2013, the wrong weather at the wrong time. And we had frogs chirping beginning of May, and a foot of snow on the ground, and we lost power for 38 hours. And that's not supposed to happen in Iowa. You don't have frogs and snow. I remember walking out to feed the cattle, and literally on Thursday night, as we had 4 inches of snow on the ground, thinking, this is really surreal, as I went down behind the dam of the pond. And then we had the wettest May, and then we had one of the coldest Julys and one of the hottest Septembers. And it was really hard to farm, and our yields indicated it here in Iowa. Corn production got made up in other parts of the country, but in Iowa, we really saw a yield decline. So climate change is real. It's happening. It's going to be very difficult for us to continue to feed a growing population if the agricultural systems we have in place now are no longer viable with a climate that's changed.
As the climate scientist, I do want to be on record saying that we have a lot of evidence that Iowa agriculture is impacted by greenhouse gas increases. And the reason that we have this evidence, where this is a little bit different than the rest of the world, is a lot of the literature you read is about the global average temperature. But in Iowa, it has more to do with our water than our temperature. And the reason for this is because the vast majority of the additional energy that's in the climate system from greenhouse gases has been absorbed by the oceans. And Iowa receives its rainfall from humidity that comes directly from the oceans. When the oceans have increased their temperature, they release more humidity to the atmosphere. And because of that, when storms are directed towards Iowa in the jet stream, then they have more humidity and they can produce more rainfall. So that is our connection to climate change at the moment. And if communities or farmers haven't adapted to a wetter spring yet, then they should, because it's something that's not going to go away. The other thing about climate change that we know going forward is, as best as we can tell, the impact on the water is the first evidence of greenhouse gases impacting agriculture in Iowa. It's most likely to be the primary impact for the next 20 to 30 years. And after that time is definitely when most of our computer projections suggest that the temperature effects will become apparent. So we have about 20 years to deal with the increases of water. Then we have to deal with increases in summer heat. And as was said just next to me now, 2013, by the middle part of the century, becomes a much more frequent event than it is nowadays. So what does that mean for agriculture in general? I think that what we are doing is creating a future agriculture that's going to require people my age and younger, who are the farmers of the future, to make very different capital investments than they make nowadays. They're going to have to reshape their farms in very serious ways. And so it's going to take a decade for practices to catch up and to be ready. The other important thing is that it's going to be a trick. It's the wrong weather at the wrong time, as was nicely said there, much more succinctly than I typically say it. As a climate scientist, it's usually filled with more numbers. But the too wet in the spring, followed by too hot in the summer, is hard. It's really hard to farm that way. And the most critical way we can deal with that is by learning to manage that wet spring and keep that water around somewhere so we can access it in the summer. So to me, those are the biggest impacts that I foresee with climate change in agriculture in Iowa.
I'm a retired rural pastor and moved from parish ministry into work with the Foods Resource Bank, which is an ecumenical hunger organization, just vibrant organization that really fosters solidarity between farmers here and global farmers. And what I've seen in that context is people's lives transformed. Yes, you know, people in the developing world who haven't had enough to eat and because of targeted, limited resources have enough food to feed their family. But people's lives transformed here because of that sense of solidarity and the way that when our eyes are opened, we can become different people and do things that we never imagined ourselves doing. So that's kind of the perspective that I bring. And I'm certainly not an expert in agriculture, but I know farmers. And I know farmers as members of congregations that I've served and as generous people with a lot of integrity. And so what I would respond to this question with another question, which is, do we even want the agricultural system that we have now? I mean, from my perspective, what I see, having served in rural congregations, worked with rural congregations on global hunger issues, and now moving to Des Moines, is I see this huge disconnect where we're at odds with each other, and there are like two different agricultural systems, and you know, really, we're all in this together. And I remember I was at a wonderful faith and food event. This was years and years ago when Craig Lang was president of Farm Bureau. And he made a statement. He was talking about how it really bothered him when he would drive by a field where he felt like farmers weren't taking care of the soil. And he said, you know, anyone who feels like they're a steward of the soil is a farmer in my book. And so we went up to him then and said, let's do an event called We're All in This Together. And we did that. And I think that what we need going forward is an agricultural system that we want. I see climate change as a huge danger, a crisis that we're dealing with right now, but also a huge opportunity for us to just say, let's stop and ask what we really want and how can we come to a place where we're working together. I'm really concerned. I think I'm concerned because of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. I think we need to do things to address that. Conversations are happening, and I'm concerned that farmers are not as much a part of those conversations as they need to be. Talk about, for instance, a climate carbon fee and dividend proposal. Farmers need to be at that table. What Foods Resource Bank tries to do is set a table where everybody has a place and every voice is heard. So I'm answering your question with a question.
The fourth speaker, farmer Arlen Schipper, took quite a different approach from the others, seeing agricultural technology as the solution to the problem.
Arlen, the question to you, you started out farming 38 years ago. If you're getting ready to set out farming now, what would you do differently, or would you?
That's kind of tough. It can be done, but farming is such a capital investment, and that's what's really going to be tough, and that's what scares me for our future. To adapt with this climate that we've been seeing, like last year, we woke up on May 2nd with 1,800 acres of corn in the ground with 8 inches of snow on it. That's scary. That tries your faith, but it did work out well. We've seen these rain clouds. We had one farm that had 2 inches of rain through the day, and that night we had another 7 inches in a short time. If you recall, New Hartford had to evacuate. That was part of this year deal. Anytime you see a cloud today, it scares you because it can happen. The double-barrel shotgun effect is happening. You lean it up against the fence, one barrel's full and the other one's empty. I mean, there's a line right here.
Mm-hmm.
To be a farmer today scares me in respect. There's no procrastination going on. When you have a chance to go, you go. because you might not have another opportunity. We need larger equipment to cover the acres possibly, or we got to run more hours. Technology's been great for us. We can run these hours at night. We'll just set the auto steer. It'll take you back and forth, whether it's dark or not. We need to utilize all these different things that we have available. I mean, the resources we have are good, but we need to continue with these resources. But with that being said, it takes a lot more capital.
Okay. Arlen, you've got a microphone in your hand, and you're a real farmer. Let's go on to question two with you, which is, how do you see agriculture adapting to climate change, whether here in Iowa or globally? What kind of an impact do you believe climate change is having on global food systems?
When I started 38 years ago, there used to be a number of Pioneer corn, 3780. Remember that corn, if any of your farmers? We use that up to 12, 15 years. That was our leading hybrid, and every company had one. The shelf life, 12, 15 years. Today, in the seed industry, with the way they can change genetics, the shelf life of any number of corn out there is maybe 3. But we can change our genetics that fast. We can adapt.
All the world is
the large question to you, what impact do you see climate change having on global food production?
So often, climate is a multiplier that takes problems that are already out there and makes them much worse. One of the big challenges in global agriculture is like what it is here. You know, farmers and in global agriculture, people are dealing with poverty. They've got a limited number of seeds that they're going to be able to plant. And they need to know traditional agriculture has been you wait and you plant right before the rainy season starts. But if you no longer know when the rainy season is going to start, you don't know when to plant. In fact, I was down in Oaxaca, Mexico last summer. And just to kind of illustrate how that multiplier effect, everybody I talk to, I'd say, are you seeing effects of climate here? And everybody, from the small farmers to somebody in the Ministry of Agriculture, said, oh, absolutely. And they would say the same thing, the unpredictability of the rains. Well, when that happened on top of an already stressed agricultural system that happened after NAFTA, you know, really made it difficult for small farmers to make it. A lot of people were telling me that people were making that the choice to migrate because that small farming that they were doing wasn't sustainable anymore. So I think that there are a lot of issues. You know, any climate aspect that stresses things is going to have an impact in agriculture. But sea level rise is huge. Not only will it displace people, but when that seawater encroaches, it leaves salt behind, and they're no longer able to farm it in the same way. It won't just be sea level rise, but sea level rise will be a huge piece of climate refugees, that where people just have to leave where they've been because they can't live there anymore. There was a study that came out of Columbia University that anticipates there could be 700 million climate refugees by, I think it was 2050.
Chris, take us global.
There are two things we have to think about here. One is the food system is already stressed, and so there's a food system adaptation that probably should occur regardless of climate change. And then the impact of climate change, as it was said here, is just an added stressor to that system that's already stressed. And there are a couple of reasons why there is so much stress on the system right now. One is there was a recent report that showed the global food production comes from a smaller number of food sources than it ever has before. We have a much less diverse food source than we've ever had before. And anything that you learn from people who study resilience is that resilience comes in when you have redundancy and alternatives. And we have neither in our food system. And so when the U.S. takes a big hit in its corn production, you know, we saw record corn prices, and that's the reason why there isn't redundancy. It's not easy to fill in a substitute. And people are relying on the same types of food sources everywhere in the whole world. So one of the important things that should happen is a no-regrets adaptation strategy would be to diversify food sources again, to create a new and more resilient global food system. As far as climate change's impact, there are two things to think about. One is what we expect to emerge in the future and what has already emerged. And it was a nice story you told about the Mexican production, because as you go farther south into the tropical regions where they have agricultural production, they are actually more vulnerable to more subtle changes. You know, just as you know from learning about geography and elementary school science classes, the sun is more persistent over the tropics, so there are fewer, there's not so much seasonality in temperature. There are some regions where there's big seasonality and rainfall, and that governs the agricultural production. But then if you have something that doesn't have much variability and you take a mean shift in that, even a small mean shift can have a huge impact. So global production is going to have regional winners and losers. There's no question about that. The tropics is one place where there could be significant losers. Another place, interestingly, but down the road, could be the Central European region, where they had historically been a big wheat-producing area. But if the climate projections hold out, their source of water is going to become less, and they're going to have a hard time producing what they have historically produced. And that's more around 30 or 40 years down the road from now. So those are the impacts that we expect to see on climate change. And I'm really interested to see the adaptations. There are going to be governmental policies that will move forward some adaptations, but I'm also interested to see some market-based adaptations. An example is that I just became aware of is one called Field to Market. And this is actually not necessarily considered an adaptation in the sense of physical, you know, physically changing how we handle the ground, but it's an adaptation in the marketplace. It's a social adaptation. And it's being forced upon the marketplace by consumers, not by not government agencies, not by changes in the climate, not by technology, but by consumers themselves. And what this is eventually going to bring about through a series of pilot studies and understanding the markets is sort of like sustainability ratings, sustainability labels, all along the supply chain for agricultural products. And it's too early to know what those sustainability ratings will mean, how harsh they will be, you know, how stringent they will be. But this is the sort of thing that needs to be adapted. It's more along the lines of our food systems, I would say, on a global scale, that we need to have adaptations.
Matt, same sort of question to you. What's a global perspective?
Yeah, I think trying to weave some of this together, we know that right now, in terms of agriculture and food, and Joan said it pretty well, that and actually, Chris, you reiterated it, that we have a challenge already, and for the most part, it's about income inequality or access to income. And so people in this room, while we do have poverty in the United States, but most of us sitting here are probably fairly resilient based on where we fall in the income scale around access to food. Well, it's the same thing when it comes to climate. When the climate changes and we start to see those impacts intensify, those with income are really going to be able to navigate that much better than those without. So it really is a sense of justice. And Arlen did a really nice job of explaining a lot of the technology that we here in Iowa and in the Midwest and the United States, we have access to adapt to climate change, react to the impacts. And one thing he didn't mention is that we have, and we just doubled down on it in the this year's Farm Bill, is that we have risk management. So even though we had in 2012 a historic drought and we had lower production, we still had very good income because farmers in the United States had access to a risk management tool that a lot of other places aren't going to have, and particularly when you're talking about the tropics and the southern hemisphere. Farmers aren't going to, they don't have access to those things. So what we're really going to see is that the challenges of climate change are going to be able to be navigated best by those with the most resources to do it, and those with the least resources are going to become the refugees and increased food insecurity. So we're going to see some serious, we already are, and we're going to continue to see some serious challenges here in the Midwest around agriculture. And we're going to continue to develop tools and develop public policy to help us navigate that and mitigate it. But if we don't, as a global community, react and figure out some strategies going forward, what we're going to see is this great inequality intensifying.
What is the best way to engage people to take action? So many people just throw up their hands and say, climate change is a huge issue. What can I do to affect it at all? How do you get people engaged and involved in this?
Well, I want to speak specifically just about the agriculture community, because I think this, I've kind of come to the realization as a farmer, as someone who works in ag policy, and as a Christian from a faith perspective, that this is really one of the large challenges of my lifetime. That, you know, I believe in the science. I believe that climate change is happening, and I believe that it is happening because of human activity. Now, the upside to that is that we're not just victims here. We can be engaged with the solution. And so I think in the last decade or so, it's been very politicized, somewhat partisan politicized, and somewhat politicized around industry, the oil and coal industry, and the the fossil fuel industry. Larry Kellum here, but Practical Farmers of Iowa. I mean, this is a great example of everybody's getting excited about cover crops, and cover crops could potentially have a big impact on soil and water, nutrient cycling and water cycling, and carbon sequestration. So these are a tool that could be very important globally. Well, farmers have been innovating on that. Practical Farmers of Iowa, one of the leaders on that. When farmers put their head to it and innovate, they come up with some tremendous things. Now industry has circled around, and the seed industries have realized that, you know, they didn't develop this, but they can sell seed now. If we hadn't had the farmers doing the innovation, we'd be years behind where we are now. And so how do you get farmers engaged so that we're innovating, talking to each other, coming up with solutions? Out of an ethic of this is something we can do. If we never get to the point that humans are causing this problem, then we can't get to that solution. So how do we get farmers interested and engaged to not necessarily have to pick sides in a partisan way? Because then we just reinforce the debate and we don't get the action that we need. But get them discussing and talking and looking at how we as farmers can find solutions.
And Chris, how do you get people involved? How do you get people worked up and actually doing something about this?
It's kind of a weird question for me to answer, because in my academic career, I'm just supposed to say the facts and let people do whatever they want to do. Right?
So, you can have an opinion, Chris. It's okay.
But, right. I do have an opinion, of course. And like most of us on this panel, I come from a family that has a farm. My family's farm is in southwest Minnesota. And I have a hard time engaging them in this discussion, my own family, right, and let alone telling them how to run the farm, mm-hmm. right? So they've been doing that since the 50s and 60s. It's not my place to tell them what to do. Okay, the solutions that I am most proud of in agriculture so far, I really am proud of the attention that cover cropping has gotten recently. And as you heard early on in my first question, what we know for certain is that our water has changed. And what we know for certain about agriculture in Iowa is that we have two advantages that a lot of places in the world don't have. We have enough water, and we have great soil. And those are points to leverage going forward. Those are resources to leverage going forward. And so if we lose that, if we lose the soil, then we've lost a big part of what we can do in this whole thing. And so I'm really proud that I know that the state has provided some programs to help first-time users of cover crops cover some of the investment in that. And I understand that it is an operational cost. It's not free to do cover crops. So that shows that the state sees the value of it, and they want to promote that type of activity. The other thing that really needs to come forward, it's on an entirely different front, is this may sound weird, but big data and big computing. And the reason why is, as was alluded to before, you can divide your farmland up into very small management units and be very site-specific about how you manage it. You wouldn't be as specific as, say, a hydroponic farm where you deliver nutrients and stuff right directly to the roots. but you can still be quite specific. And this is all tied to all the data that gets collected from GPS farming, from all the data that are available from federal agencies that provide weather data, for example. And so the people who can put computing together with the big data and come up with nicely interfaced solutions for conservation, for reduced management inputs, that sort of stuff, those are the people that can make a big difference in a real short period of time.
Joan, what's your magic formula for getting people involved?
Stop blaming. Before I moved back to Iowa, served for a number of years up in a town in Minnesota of about 2,000 where probably 14 different languages were spoken. And so we had things to deal with. And what I learned in that situation, I heard Andrew Young speak one time. And, you know, somebody who'd been so much a part of the civil rights movement, somebody who I felt like I really needed to listen to, UCC clergy person. And he said, people can only change if they can change without blame. I just said I was concerned. I mean, that's, for me, that's how it started. I think we need to have the climate conversation. And that, to me, that doesn't mean going and beating people up and saying, and finding the people that'll most disagree and having a fight. I think nobody can argue with me when I say, I'm concerned about climate. They may not be, they may be. But what's happened is I've done that, is people have come up to me in at least two or three different situations and in tears because they haven't been in situations where they've been able to have that climate conversation. My 10-year-old neighbor came over to have a what she calls a spot of tea with me last week, and I told her about this panel. And I said, do you learn about climate in school? She said, yeah. I said, well, what do you know? She said, I know that if climate changes fast, really bad things happen. Well, are her folks talking to her about that? I think we need to have the climate conversation.
And Arlen, I'm not going to blame you for anything. But the question I would have for you, as a farmer, do you think farmers are ready for this discussion, or are farmers even ahead of the rest of society on this issue?
I think the biggest issue on climate right now is there is no awareness. To be honest with you, until this winter, I really never even looked into it either. Things have happened. We've had them happen before. But it is kind of scary when I've seen a couple documentaries and so forth. Now, whether this is happening or not, I don't know. My theory is this: to be a Christian farmer, we need to do good stewardship no matter what, whether there's a potential of it happening or if it's a catastrophic thing that's happening tomorrow or if it never happens. We still need to be the good steward. And if we all get involved, and we are, and that's where we need to work on this panel is tremendous. We need to bring awareness to everybody to let people know.
You've been listening to KHOI's Heart of Iowa, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and individuals of note in central Iowa. On this Earth Day, we featured Ed Fallon, host of the Fallon Forum, on the road with the Great March for Climate Action, followed by excerpts from the March 30th panel, Agriculture and Climate Change, with Susan Guy, Mark Glover, Christopher Anderson, Joan Fumetti, Mark Russell, and Arlen Shipper.